This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik with Howard Wilkinson. From snoring and sleep apnea to stress and maybe even the pizza you had for dinner, lots of factors can keep you from getting a good night's sleep. We're going to talk today about what might be causing the problem and what you can do to get your rest. Then later in the hour, we'll hear from Councilman David Mann. It's been 40 years since he entered politics. But first, joining us to talk about sleep is director of the University of Cincinnati Sleep Medicine Center, Dr. Victoria Sudulescu. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. And Dr. Sudulescu is joining us on the phone. Good afternoon.
Hi, Marianne. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Thanks for being here.
Yes.
I'd like to start out to talk a little bit just about the causes of sleep disorders, because a lot of people have them, and I think there can be a lot of reasons for them. Why don't you tell us what can cause a sleep disorder?
Thank you. Yeah, surely that is a great question. I would like to frame it a bit, though, if I may, and start by thinking about sleep just for a few seconds. And it's such a routine, everyday activity. I believe that we are not as tuned into its causes or effects or what can go wrong in the night, so to speak, things that may surround or happen during sleep. So first of all, before we talk about what can go wrong with this basically physiologic state, right, because we live awake and we live asleep, and that's about the two states of existence that we, you know, we go about our lives within. So what is sleep? That's, you know, I'm putting the question back on you, and I don't expect to answer. I'm just going to, it's really an unknown answer type question, because we don't understand well what sleep is. We know what sleep isn't. We know it's not coma. We know it's not death. We know that if sleep doesn't happen, things go wrong. We all can relate to that. When we pull an all-nighter or we have a sleep disorder, you know, things during the day start to work less well. So, but we don't understand very clearly what sleep is. Sleep is a physiologic state, and so we know for sure that sleep is a requirement, and there's a quote that doesn't belong to me that I learned when I was going to training, and which says, if sleep is not a necessity, then it is the biggest mistake evolution has made. So why? Because it's a third of our lives, truly. If you imagine, you know, it's a third of all, it's the biggest chunk of anything we do in one kind of concentrated, condensed spot, which is the sleep, the habitual sleep period.
So you would say it is a necessity, obviously.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely.
Tell us how important it is. How much time do people need to sleep a night?
Yeah, that's another great question. And the short answer is adults, about 8 hours. And please don't smile or snicker at this thing, because you know, there's another great piece of trivia. It's not really trivia, but, you know, there was a study. There was actually a survey done in 1901. That is 1900s. You know, that is more than 100 years ago. That showed that people around that time slept about 9 hours a night. And so, of course, we have nowadays, fast forward to 2012, National Sleep Foundation, Sleep in America poll, and the amount of time the Americans self-report they spent asleep a day is gradually and clearly going down with each successive poll, down to about, if I remember correctly, 645 minutes or so lately. And that's general people. That's not necessarily people with sleep disorders. So I'm bringing you back to the more than 2 hour difference in about 100 year span. Clearly, we know this from Darwin on, evolution and nature or God, whoever people believe in, does not change a human body, the physiology of it, in that to require, you know, a quarter of a physiologic activity to decrease over a span of 100 years. That's just too short of a time for an evolutionary change. So that basically begs the corollary that we are doing it to ourselves. It's not something that is natural. All that I'm trying to say in a very convoluted way is that we are sleep deprived as a society. So we probably believe about need. I'm sorry, I apologize. We need about 8 hours. We certainly don't get that.
And we impose, doctor. We impose that upon ourselves. I mean, we make that choice.
Howard, that is exactly correctly. You have hit the nail on the head, so to speak. It is a societal decision.
But by choosing less sleep, and I am the queen of not getting enough sleep because I work really weird hours here.
Oh, I have to have a talk with you.
Well, I mean, you know, I get up at 3 every day to come to work, so it's not a time where I don't get a lot of sleep. I try to get bits and pieces of sleep, so I'll sleep a little at night, I'll take a nap during the day. Do you have to have all that sleep at once?
Well, the answer is yes, and the answer is depending on the individual and their ability to cope with basically shift work, which is what you're describing, right?
Yes.
Which means working on a different schedule than, again, what God or nature left for us. You know, because, again, going back, you know, I have a speech that I deliver to my trainees and it kind of goes like this, or to my patients that come with the possibility of a shift work sleep disorder, which is what we're talking about right now. The speech kind of goes like this. We are left onto this world to be up during the day and down and asleep at night. We are not bats or rats to be up at night and forage and, you know, sleeping during the day. When we interfere with that because of, and then fill in the blank, you know, job requirements, small babies waking us up, pets in the beds, TV shows, I could go on and on, right, talking about societal and pressures that interfere with our ability to create a sleep-prone environment. When we interfere with that, chances are we pay the price. All of us? No. All of us in the same amount? Probably not. Some of us are more well-equipped to cope with this than others, and if we had the answer to that, we would be much more advanced in the field of sleep medicine. We don't know why left to the same sleep schedule or lack thereof. Some people report less sleepiness or less daytime impairment than others, but we know that's true.
Doctor, is it a myth that as you get older, you need less sleep?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. So we don't need less sleep as we get older. Now, that being said, define older, because, you know, if you consider your starting point birth, we do get and we need less sleep as we progress through maturity, through the normal, through childhood and adolescence, because we start out sleeping, 16, 18 hours a day as babies, right? And then we go to about 10, 11, in the teens, preteens, tweens, something like that. And then we go towards the 8-hour requirement average. I'm talking average. You know, there are individual variations. We can talk about that if you'd like.
Once somebody hits their 60s or 70s, how much sleep do you think they should get at that point?
About 8 hours.
So why is it that so many older people you hear say, you know, I just don't sleep as much?
Because this is kind of how the story goes. We need our need for sleep plateaus in our 20s probably to about whatever requirement. Let's say it's 8 hours, 7.5, 8.5, whatever. But that need for sleep plateaus and stays the same for the rest of our existence. However, the amount of sleep we get and the interferences that exert influence on the amount of sleep we get, those, we accumulate more of those as we advance in age, because unfortunately we accumulate a host of medical, psychiatric, psychological problems, stressors, family, social pressures, again, that all impose their burden on the quantity and quality of the sleep we get. So the problem is not that older people need less sleep, older people get less sleep because of the amount of other things that impinge upon their ability to fall asleep and stay asleep.
Well, doctor, I'm 61 years old, and I find that...
You're a young 61.
Yes.
You should say I'm 61 years.
61.
See, I said 61 years young. That's
that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
But I do find that, you know, I tend to go to bed earlier and I wake earlier. Is that typical, common?
It's interesting. So if it doesn't bother you, it's okay.
Yeah.
Or others. You know, it's kind of like the beauty is in the eye of the beholder, right? So if it's not a problem that interferes with your activity or your desired activity or with your social or professional or family or whatever life, then it's okay. If it starts becoming a problem, then I would suggest, and of course I do this in my heavily biased state of a sleep specialist, right, position, I would suggest that you let yourself, you know, you talk to someone about the possibility of this entity called, are you ready? It's a mouthful.
Mm-hmm.
Circadian rhythm sleep disorder advanced sleep phase type. It's got two parts of a name. So yeah, I told you. I warned you. I gave you fair warning. Circadian rhythm sleep disorder, all that it means is that it's a disorder of the timing of your sleep, because that's what we're talking about. You're talking about an advanced timing. And the advanced sleep phase type pinpoints that the disorder looks at advanced sleep phase as opposed to sleeping, you know, later or sleeping on what we call free running when there's really basically no rhyme or reason or when you go to sleep when you wake up.
I just want everyone to know our guest today, director of the University of Cincinnati Sleep Medicine Center, Dr. Victor.
I have to correct that. I'm sorry, Marianne. It was up to July 1st. I'm staff physician at the UC Health Center. I did direct the center for 14 years or so. We're almost, or 11, I should say.
Okay, so you're staff physician at the Cincinnati Sleep Medical Center, Dr. Victoria Sertulescu. Yes, if you have a question or a comment, our number is 513-419-7100. Greg's calling from Oxford. Hi, Greg. What's your question? Greg?
Yes.
Yes. What's your question, please?
Hi. Dr. Sertulescu, this is Greg Rutherford. My first statement is that I want the public to know how important this is. And Dr. Sertulescu changed my life.
Oh, my goodness. You came online to say that.
So you must have had sleep troubles?
There are two types of sleep apnea, and I hope that you will address the central versus the obstructive. As it happens, I have suffered from both.
Okay, well, let's have her explain what sleep... I'm going to interrupt you, Greg, because we have such a short period of time. Sertulescu, would you please explain what sleep apnea is for people that may not know?
Sure, and then we'll let Greg again. But so one of the sleep disorders has to do with an impairment of breathing during sleep. Breathing is a vital function, just like sleep. And breathing and sleep have to coexist because we would like to wake up alive every morning. When we wake up, for that, we have to breathe. However, during sleep, there are periods of time where breathing may cease, and that's highly and clearly abnormal. And the breathing cessation, just like Greg was mentioning, can happen of two flavors. One, a very common one called obstructive sleep apnea, where basically tongue falls backwards when breathing takes place. When you try to suck air in, what happens with your upper airway is what happens with a thin paper straw. When you suck a thick milkshake through it, it collapses, right? So tongue falls backwards and the airway collapses and there's no breathing, and that's obstructive. And then, of course, there is the other type of breathing called central sleep apnea, where there's no drive to breathe. So there's no effort to breathe that makes the airway collapsible. Breathing simply stops, and that's usually a higher control, you know, a neurological problem. Or sometimes we don't know why it is. We call it idiopathic sleep apnea because we don't have, you know, a better explanation for it.
But now, Greg, I'm going to go back to Greg here. Greg, you were able to get some help by using a BiPAP machine?
Yes, I use a BiPAP machine, which is a multi-pressure machine, and there are... Actually, I guess three principal machines. I have a new machine I'm trying to learn on, which is sort of fuzzy logic in how it addresses my sleep difficulties. But the CPAP, I believe, is pressure, positive pressure only. The BiPAP has two pressure settings, so it is rhythmic in working with your inhalation, exhalation patterns as you sleep.
Well, Greg, I am so happy to hear that that's helped you. I really appreciate your call. We do need to move on.
Same here.
Number.
Thank you very much for input, Greg. Thank you.
513-419-7100 is our number if you have a question or a comment. Hashna is calling from Hartwell. Hello. Hello. Hashna, are you there? Or Hasna? I'm sorry if I've said your name wrong.
No, it's Hasna.
Hasna, yes. What's your question, please?
My question is, once you've been diagnosed with sleep apnea and have had a TNA, a tonsillectomy, and adenoidectomy, is it possible for sleep apnea to come back?
Excellent question. Yeah, so tonsils actually don't grow back, but adenoids do. So to put the question back at you, probably I'm assuming, or whoever had the intervention, or I'm assuming that there is a sleep study or some confirmation of the fact that the surgery actually worked in resolving the sleep apnea. And if that's the case, you know, the answer ideally is yes. What I'm trying to say is that once sleep apnea was diagnosed, if any intervention, such as surgical intervention or CPAP for that matter, is employed, there has to be some evidence that the problem was taken care of, right? Because otherwise you wouldn't move forward thinking you took care of it. I say that with emphasis because unfortunately too many times we see patients who undergo actually procedures much more involved than a TNA, than a tonsillectomy and adenectomy, such as multiple airway obstruction surgery, multiple level airway obstruction surgery, and they don't benefit from a follow-up sleep test. That those type of surgeries clearly will address snoring, so those patients won't snore, and they can be lulled into the false sense of security that a sleep apnea is gone, and that may not be the case. So anyway, so my first question is, was there confirmation that the sleep apnea was addressed? And if yes, if sleep apnea was cured by the procedure alone, then to address specifically your question, yes, it can come back through several mechanisms. One, and it pains me to say that, but I will nevertheless, simply through the passage of time. Now, I don't say aging because we don't age. I don't know about you all, but I don't age. No, we go backwards, right? So that was a joke. But
I don't know about that, but yeah.
Yeah, so just simply passage of time does things on our upper airway muscle tone and the ability to maintain a good tone during sleep, which is truly out of our control. And so sleep apnea can recur, even though we did open the airway and we made an impact and progress or perhaps cure with the first surgery, you know, way back when. Now, second mechanism through sleep apnea, through which sleep apnea may recur after a deemed curative intervention, such as a surgical intervention like you, Hashna, mentioned, is weight gain. And again, you know, 5 or 10 pounds may not matter, but if people gain, you know, 50 or I've seen, you know, 100 pounds or things like that, sleep apnea will definitely, through different mechanism than first time around, recur.
Okay, thank you so much. I'm going to let Hasna go here because we've got so many other people on the line. Thanks
all
so
right.
much for your call.
Right.
We're going to go now to Molly and Mason. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Molly and Mason.
Molly, what's your question?
Can you hear me?
Yes, go right
yes.
ahead, please.
Okay, I had a question. I have a daughter who was actually born bilaterally and ophthalmic. She does not have eyes and no light perception as well. And my question is, how imperative is light perception to maintaining a healthy circadian rhythm?
How old is she, if I may ask?
She will be 5 in August.
All right, so to answer your question, I have a 5-year-old also, so to answer your question, very. So we think of light as the most important stimulus for maintaining sleep-wake cycle. I don't say day-night cycle because that's something obviously out of our control that happens anyway, but the way we perceive that, that entrains our body to what we call circadian rhythm, basically that we go to sleep at night, wake up during the day. And so even people, and this is going to be a story, you know, perhaps will help your understanding of this, although I do hope, and you don't have to answer this, certainly not on air, but I do hope that you are, of course, you know, in close relationship with the Children's Sleep Center, which is great, phenomenal. We are extremely lucky in Cincinnati to have one of the, you know, top-notch pediatric sleep disorder centers in the country. And I feel privileged to work with them, and I actually received my training there, so on and so forth. So anyway, that aside, I was trying to go back to the lack of light perception. We know from studies in people who don't perceive light at all, they're blind, but they're not enucleated. They have eyeballs. So we know that those people also get entrained in the light-dark cycle into a normal wake-sleep cycle. So we know that light simply light stimulus to certain receptors in the back of the retina, in the back of the eye on the retina, even though there's no light perception, no image that forms in the brain, you can't see, you're blind, right? One is blind. But the light stimulus can and will entrain people to healthy, or I should say societal acceptable, sleeping at night, awake during the day.
Is there anything Molly can do to help her daughter recognize the difference between night and day?
Yeah, take her to the children's sleep disorder center.
All right. Well, Molly, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate
it. She does get some melatonin for pediatric use, which helps her fall asleep. It's kind of maintaining the sleep that she can have difficulty with.
Well, yeah, Molly, yeah. We do need to move on, but I thank you so much for calling, and I think we're going to be talking about sleep again.
And I wish you good luck, Molly.
We have so much to say. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. Donna's calling now from Independence. Hi, Donna. What's your question?
Hi. About 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease.
Okay.
And naturally, you started taking a regimen of carbidopa, levodopa to handle the...
That makes you sleepy.
The motor problems.
Right.
My sleep pattern has been changing in the last year so that I wake up at 2, 3 in the morning. And miraculously, my motor symptoms have improved to the point where I really can accomplish a tremendous amount.
Awesome.
I don't have to take any medicine. It seems like that sleep benefit lasts until 9 o'clock in the morning when I have to start then taking the carbidopa. Since I'm retired, I have the benefit, the option of changing my sleep-wake cycle to fit my disease. My question is, has anybody done any research on sleep benefit and why sometimes even after 2 hours of sleep, I can wake up, I can walk freely, I'm energetic. One of the big problems.
So, did you have a question, or were you
lack of motivation? You become apathetic to everything. In the middle of the night, when I get up, I can go to grocery store. Thankfully, Kroger's open 24/7.
I hope you don't.
I can do my laundry.
Just a second, Doctor Sertoleski. You say you hope she doesn't. Why is that?
Well, because she will, obviously, she's working towards reversing or reverting or switching completely her sleep-wake cycle. If she is by now, Donna, right?
Correct.
Yes. Donna, if you use, so what are you experiencing, first of all, is the benefit of sleep, of good quality sleep, that on your background of motor symptoms, you know, you feel at your best basically first when you wake up, which is great, and it's as it's supposed to be. My advice would be for you not to ride that wave, so to speak, and don't become too attached to the idea that night is your best time, simply because I've seen it happen where the next thing you'll do, you'll end up suffering from sleep deprivation because you're trying now to cram too many things at a time of the day when you should really be asleep.
Thank you so much for calling. I'm going to move on. We're just about out of time. I want to get one more call in. Liz from Loveland. Hi, Liz. What's your question?
My question is, can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead, please.
Absolutely. Hi, Liz.
Okay, sorry. In the 1990s, I was diagnosed with a lack of REM sleep after 2 years of trying to find out what was wrong with me, to the point where I lost the ability to walk and move my joints comfortably. We hear a lot about apnea today, but what is the stance of research on the quality and type of sleep in terms of our health?
Right. So another great question, and clearly not one that we will have enough time to delve into, but the long and the short of it is as follows. We understand, you know, I lied. I will be the first one to admit at the beginning of the show, I said we live in sleep and wake state, and I'm going to take that back, and I did it because I didn't know what an astute audience I have and how sophisticated people are, and I should have. We actually live in three states of being. It's wakefulness, all of us now, I hope, while we converse on the phone. Dream sleep or REM sleep, and non-REM sleep or light and deep sleep, like they used to be called, not anymore because we don't understand what light and deep means, but we know that one is dream and the other one is non-dream or non-REM sleep. Now, there is a clearly very well-defined and finely tuned balance and percentage proportion between REM and non-REM sleep that needs to be accomplished for us to function well. When that's disturbed by a lot of things, then dysfunction, daytime impairment happens. That can be as subtle as people become just slightly, perhaps more on the edge, or maybe their spouses feel like they're less understanding than they used to be, and they claim it on, but honey, you know, it's not honeymoon anymore, and that's not, probably not true. Or perhaps, you know, even more significant psychiatric disturbances like personality changes, or perhaps impairment in daytime alertness. People fall asleep, or people just can't do their job properly, and they're labeled as lazy when all they are actually really suffering from a sleep disorder. So to answer your question, yes, there has to be a balance. And that's about all we can say with the amount of time we have.
That's right. We are out of time. Liz, thank you so much for your call. And Dr. Sertulescu, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to help with spreading the awareness. Thank you.
You can join. We've been talking, rather, with the University of Cincinnati Sleep Medicine Center, Dr. Victoria Sertulescu. In just a moment, we'll hear about the 40-year political career of Cincinnati Councilman David Mann. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.